tonight for $79.95. You saved. And now, here from Chicago, he's actually in this country right now, I think, Chicago, here's Graham Hancock. Graham, hi.
Hi, Art. How are you doing? Nice to talk to you again.
Good. Great talk to you as well, Graham. Graham, I've been following really closely a story down off the coast of Cuba.
Me too.
About this apparent, I don't know, they say it's like a city with structures, with buildings, with pyramids, with roads, with and half a mile under the ocean, 2,200 some odd feet below the surface of the ocean off the coast of Cuba. People have said, well, gee, maybe it's Atlantis, and people are thinking all kinds of things. Paulina Zelitsky, the Cuban / Russian scientist who's found all this.
That's right.
And
extraordinary.
I know,
it's an extraordinary story.
Yes.
And one of the most extraordinary things about it is that it's still not been possible to put the necessary funding in place to do the complete research there to satisfy us all on what it actually is. And that, unfortunately, is because there's a mindset in science that says such things just cannot be, and therefore it must be some kind of optical illusion on the sonar scans, or some kind of illusion that we're seeing on the video images that have been brought back by the remotely operated vehicles.
Have you been privileged to see these? Yeah,
I've seen some of the images, and for when I was researching Underworld, the new book, we talked to Pauline Zelitsky and we talked to other people around her, and I've included material and discussion of this in the new book. And what's amazing is that over the last few months, it really hasn't moved forward much. And this to me says, where are our priorities in research, and why do we get so focused on a particular idea of the past that when something new and intriguing comes like this, we don't have scientists rushing from all over the world to put in the necessary funding to provide the equipment to get down there and find out what's going on. I mean, at this stage, you have to say, maybe, maybe not. I am more and more inclined to the view that we are looking at the remains of a great city underwater. But it has to be settled with research in the field. And the staggering thing is, although we've known about this for more than a year now, that it's not been possible to put in place the necessary equipment and personnel to do this research properly. I hope that it will come. The depth of the site is the most mysterious thing about it.
What do we know about that? In other words, in order for something to have gone below the surface that far, how old would that, in conventional thinking, how old would that make whatever's down there?
Okay, well, here's the first issue is the issue of sea level rise at the end of the ice age. That accounts for about 400 feet of submersion. That in itself was a dramatic series of events that raised sea level by 400 feet and swallowed up 10 million square miles of the best land on Earth.
Well, that only leaves us with 2,200.
Exactly. This site's 2,200 feet underwater.
Yeah.
So we've got 1,800 feet of submersion left to account for. This is a very serious problem. One possibility, and scientists I've talked to say that it's a real possibility in that area, is that in addition to the sea level rise issue, we may be dealing with some kind of underwater landslide, which carried down a slope a whole mass of man-made construction and carried it down to a much greater depth than it would have otherwise gone. The other possibility is massive tectonic activity, but in earthquakes. But in both cases, you have to ask yourself how the material has managed to remain so intact through such a cataclysm that would carry it so deep. If it had been submerged by sea level rise alone, the possibility of it remaining intact is there. But if it's been submerged by massive earthquake or a massive underwater landslide, it's amazing that it's still intact. Nevertheless, miracles do happen. The other possibility, much further out there, is that we're dealing with something from a different epoch of human civilization entirely. As you know, I focus a lot on the last 12,000 years, the last 13, 14,000 years, the end of the Ice Age and the huge sea level rise that took place then.
So you don't rule out the possibility it could be Atlantis?
No, I don't rule out that possibility. It's in eerily the right place to fit in with Plato's description. Plato's very clear on his dates, and he puts the submersion of Atlantis 9,000 years before the story reached the Greeks, which in our terms is 9,600 BC, which is 11,500 years ago. And dramatic and extraordinary things were happening in the world at that time, and there was a huge sea level rise, and huge floods were pouring off the melting ice caps on land. But still, if it's 11,500 years ago, we have to find some other factor that explains the depth of submergence beyond sea level rise, and at the same time explains the site staying as intact as it seems to have done. So I think we have one of the great scientific mysteries of our time, and it's just very sad that science has responded to it with the usual cynicism and dismissal, which leads us to ignore so much that could enlighten us about ourselves.
Well, I know you're probably not going to have an answer for this, but one thing I thought about when I first heard about the story was that, you know, we've been at odds with Cuba for a long time.
Yes.
And without any doubt, U.S. submarines, as well as those submarines of many other nations,
you bet,
have been all over that ocean bottom.
Yeah.
And so our U.S. naval forces would be well aware, or should be well aware.
I would think that they know a thing or two, and not just there.
Yeah.
But in many other underwater locations as well. It's true that the military have a much better idea of what's on the seafloor than we do.
Uh-huh.
In some places, it just might not be in their strategic interest to talk too much about that. So that knowledge could be there and might not be made public. In fact, I would be surprised if it was.
And as you mentioned, not just there, but perhaps sites that we haven't even discovered yet, that we don't even know about. Certainly the military would be aware of them.
Indeed. There's a very, very good chance that they are, and precisely because they are military, that knowledge is military, there's also a very good chance that it would not be made public. Because were it to be made public, then that would reveal how much is known about the whole sea.
Do you think, other than strictly military reasons, Graham, there would be other reasons and for them not to make such a thing public? I mean, even if there was no military secrecy reason for it, would there be other reasons you can think of?
There would be quite a few other reasons that I can think of. I think that that the prospect of lost civilizations, particularly one that may belong, as I said earlier on, to a totally other epoch of the human past. I mean, as I said, I have focused on the last 12,000 to 15,000 years and what happened in that period, and we're not considering the possibility that there may have been human cultures that are lost to our memory long, long before that. And if we go far enough back in the time frame, we may find a way to account for the submersion of this site without a massive earthquake that should have destroyed all the structures that would leave it looking the way that it does. But at the end of the day, these ideas, and I've come to realize this more and more as I've dealt with this subject over the years, these ideas are quite subversive. It rocks the boat, if you'll excuse the pun.
Mm-hmm.
It shakes things up very badly to consider that our whole idea of how we evolved and developed as a species, as a culture, as a civilization, that this whole idea is wrong. If that's the bedrock on which we construct our reality today, is our sense of the past. And if it's all wrong and we're missing enormous chapters in the human story, perhaps not just going back 12,000 or 15,000 years, although that's extraordinary enough, but going back 100,000 or 200,000 years or 500,000 years into the past, if evidence comes to light which shows that is indeed so, then almost everything about modern reality suddenly gets shaky. Its foundations are knocked out from under it, and we begin to question everything in the world. We begin to question the whole judgment of science on what humans are about and what we're for.
And we're not really big enough to be doing that yet.
I think not. I think that we're not big enough to be doing that yet. It's a disturbing position, and it has implications for the modern world that we live in. It leads to a questioning of the whole establishment view. And once that happens, it starts to run away with itself, and people begin to see the possibility of anarchy and chaos. And
yeah, I'm sure that you're familiar with the Brookings report about the probable impact of extraterrestrial
Indeed.
Intelligence and all the rest of it. Well,
Indeed.
Doesn't this fit right into that in the same sense? In other words, it would shake the bedrock of everything we believe as badly, at least, as information that ET is real.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. In some ways, even more, because it strikes at the roots of what we think ourselves to be. It causes us to question everything about our own past, and therefore everything about our own present, and the methods that we use to understand the human predicament, which these days are based on a very hard-headed scientific point of view. It's become the new religion. We're persuaded that science has the answers for everything. Well, suppose we suddenly find out that science, the answers that science gave us about the story of our past is just completely wrong, and we've just been looking at the tip of the iceberg, and that there's a huge depth of history and prehistory behind us when things happened that we haven't reckoned with at all. It's very disturbing. I think it's very exciting, but it's also very disturbing, and you can see why people might feel, were they privy to that knowledge, this knowledge is better kept quiet.
Does what is suggested and what we see on the side scan radar and all the rest of it, what's suggested down there, does that jive with other stuff that we're finding in the world?
Yes, it does. I mean, again, this has been a primary focus for me for the last 4 or 5 years has been the quest that has led to the new book, Underworld, and the point of Underworld.
By the way, how did you begin this quest? I mean, why suddenly looking
underwater? Well, it was a number of things. It was partly a reaction to my critics, and I have many of those who said, "Listen, Hancock is talking about lost civilizations, and he's comparing strange similarities all around the world, and well and good, but he's not giving us any hard evidence." So I looked long and hard at the mythology of the world, which is dominated by flood myths, and which speaks of a terrible series of cataclysms that destroyed a former civilization. It's amazing how many myths and traditions there are around the world like this. So that what they all have in common is that civilization was destroyed by water, was destroyed by being covered by the sea, by the ocean. And I asked myself, could this ever have happened within the reasonable past of our culture as we know it? And true enough, it did happen at the end of the Ice Age. Between roughly 17,000 and 7,000 years ago, there was this 400-foot rise in sea level, and a staggering amount of land went underwater and disappeared from view. And archaeologists will tell you, hey, we've got that tape too. We have marine archaeologists, and they've explored underwater. Well, no, they haven't really explored underwater. There is marine archaeology. They do good work, but more than 90% of it is concerned with looking for shipwrecks. And the place you look for shipwrecks is not necessarily the place you look for lost civilizations. The marine archaeology that's been done specifically looking for sites on those areas of land that were flooded at the end of the Ice Age is an extremely tiny proportion of the whole. And set against the more than 10 million square miles of good land that were washed away and covered at the end of the Ice Age, it's infinitesimally small. They've hardly touched it. Virtually the entire coast of India, vast coastline, has just never been inspected by archaeologists at all, for example. Same with Africa. Same with Southeast Asia. And oddly enough, in India, in the two places that have been inspected, we found extremely unexpected underwater ruins, which don't make sense at all. And I think gradually what's happening as more and more research is done in this field, and I've tried to open the door with this, with Underworld, by going diving myself and seeing this stuff for myself. As more and more is done and people become aware of this possibility, and particularly as scuba divers all around the world become aware that there might be more down there than fish and pretty coral, that we are going to find even more. I think we're we're at the beginning of a new epoch of exploration, where all the dreams and mysteries and myths of the past turn out to be true, rooted and grounded in truth, and we should be kicking ourselves for not having listened to them long ago.
Well, one would suppose that these myths would survive if even just a few humans somehow survive. I mean, yeah. they would be carried forth, and that's exactly what's occurred. Now, I don't know. I mean, after all, we know that if you put a long chain of people and they whisper something down the line, you end up with a different story at the end. So
yeah.
It may not be exactly as told, but there's probably some nugget of truth.
Exactly. It bears some relationship to the original thing. And this was what haunted me, was this feeling that we had these stories from all around the world, all essentially speaking of the same thing. So I felt in the quite correct demand of my critics to present more evidence for a lost civilization that the best place I could possibly look for that evidence was underwater. And when I turned to science for further information, I worked with a top-class geologist who's one of the world's top three experts in sea level rise. His information showed that in the places where the flood myths are thickest on the ground, where we hear most about a great flood,
right.
These are also the places that were most extensively flooded at the end of the Ice Age. And at that point, I saw a strategy unfolding, which, of course, I cannot search the whole of the world's oceans on my own. I don't have any institutional funding. I must narrow down the search, so I narrowed it down using science and using myths. And that was one reason why I wrote Underworld. But another reason was simple curiosity, which was sparked off in Japan when I was traveling there back in 1996.
All right, hold that thought, Graham. We're here at the bottom of the hour, and so we'll take a break. And the story about Japan is equally fascinating because it probably leads right into the story about Cuba. My guest is Graham Hancock. We're talking about what's beneath our oceans, something perhaps long forgotten, but not entirely forgotten, because the words are still told by those charged with remembering them. I'm Art Bell.
What will you do when you get lonely? No one waiting by your side. You've been running, I don't rush too long. You know.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255, east of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222, and the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
Graham Hancock's new book is Underworld, A Quest for the City of Below. And that's what we're talking about tonight, what may be down at the bottom of our oceans. We already have a great deal of indication something's off the coast of Cuba, something big. But there's prior evidence about something off the coast of Japan, specifically, actually, the Ryukyu Islands, now part of Japan, Okinawa. We'll be right back.
First Horizon Home Loans. We know buying a home can be stressful, but there's at least one thing that isn't. Getting your loan from us. We draw on the strength of a nationwide network of loan officers who will guide you every step of the way so you can move on to the things you'd rather be doing, like enjoying your new home. Call 800-600-4400 today. That's 800-600-4400. First Horizon Home Loans. Get home with less stress.
All right, once again, here's Graham Hancock from Chicago. He's in the country right now. Nice to have you here, Graham. All right, so I know...
Can I just pick you up on the book, by the way?
Oh, of course.
Because the subtitle that you gave, the main title is right, Underworld, but the subtitle is actually The Mysterious Origins of Civilization.
It changed then.
It changed, yeah. That took me back. But that's the subtitle. And TLC are running the TV series with yet another name, which is Flooded Kingdoms of the Ice Age.
A Quest for the City Below would also be all right.
It was lovely. But in the end, I decided that the focus really is on the mysterious origins of civilization. So that's why I gave Underworld that subtitle. And can I get in one more small plug here?
Of course.
Since you mentioned that I am in the States, I am indeed. I'm in Chicago at the moment. I'm going back to New York tomorrow, where I'm giving a lecture in a Barnes & Noble in Chelsea, New York, at 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm giving lectures also in Boulder and in Denver and at three locations around San Francisco and also in Portland, Oregon, and in Seattle. And obviously, we don't want to go use up airtime to give the details of all of these places, but on my website, on the Underworld page of my website, is a complete tour schedule for me, the bookshops, the contacts, at www.grahamhancock.com. And if anybody in the wonderful Art Bell audience, which I know from past experience is a great audience of thinking people, would like to come along to those talks, if they happen to be in those areas, they'll find that on the Underworld page of grahamhancock.com.
All right. Just before we go to Japan, one quick question. I mean, in terms of myths, or perhaps not, but things written in the Bible, for example. I mean, there's Noah, and there was the very great flood, right?
Indeed. I mean, this is the first contact that many of us have with the worldwide phenomenon of the so-called flood myth, which I think the word myth, unfortunately, it's there in our language and we don't have any other word to use for it, but it's so often used to mean something that isn't true, something that's a fantasy, something that's an invention, and what I'm learning is that it so often is true. Well, our first contact with the worldwide flood story is indeed through the Bible and through the Old Testament and the story of Noah, and that story does absolutely speak of a former civilization, the antediluvian civilization, which became wicked and which was punished with the great flood that Noah survived, and we're told that it was his line, his children, that passed down to future generations of mankind.
Well, of course, you know, a lot of people, scientists even, say that it's just plain impossible for there to be a lost civilization that predates a modern man.
Exactly.
Because otherwise we'd have evidence
that's
of
right.
it.
That's right. And lo and behold,
you're beginning to get that.
Well, that's exactly why I set out to write Underworld, because I believe that call for evidence is reasonable. I think that if somebody is putting himself up as challenging the existing model, which I have been doing, then A, I should expect to be fiercely criticized and attacked, which I have been.
Oh, yes.
And B, I should be required to produce the hard evidence that scientists can understand. And so that's what I've tried to do. And I've asked myself many times why there is this almost religious commitment to a particular model of history, and I've experimented with all kinds of ideas, you know.
Well, that's because in part it is a religious commitment.
It is. There's no doubt that science in many ways is the new religion.
Yep.
which abolishes all things that cannot be weighed or measured or counted as simply not existing. But, you know, I've asked myself, is it some kind of conspiracy to hide the truth? I think often it's not. I think the people that I've come up against, for the most part, the very large majority of them are decent, honest people who truly, deeply, and passionately believe in the model of the past that they work with. And therefore they feel that anybody who is providing an alternative view, who's saying, no, that's possibly wrong, you have to consider other things, that that person is not only wrong, but in some way evil, and in some way out to mislead the public from the true path. It's anybody who's studied the story of the Inquisition in the Catholic Church from about the early 13th century onwards will find great similarities between what was done to heretics then and what is done now. And I think in a world that has become largely unspiritual and dominated by material thinking and dominated by science, science is the new religion. And the reaction that that opponents get is the reaction that formerly was given to heretics, except now they can't actually burn us at the stake.
Well, hopefully. you heard about something happening in Japan. How did that happen, and then how did you follow it up?
I first visited Japan in 1996, and the reason that I visited there was because my book, Fingerprints of the Gods, for some reason that I still don't understand to this day, took off like a rocket in Japan, and it was enormously popular there. And the publishers asked me to go there several times to further promote the book and to give public lectures. And at several of these public lectures, I was approached by Japanese citizens, ordinary people, not scientists, many of them were divers, who showed me photographs of weird and mysterious structures looking almost like pyramids underwater. And I said, my God, what is this? And they said, well, we don't know, but it's been found, and the one they were focusing on was off an island called Yonaguni, which is very near to Taiwan. The most southwestern of all the Japanese islands, in fact, Yonaguni is. The more I looked at these images and the more my Japanese contacts talked to me about them, the more I thought, I got to go and see this stuff for myself. I've got to find out what's going on here. It's so weird. And what's it doing underwater? And that's when I really started to think about sea level rise as an issue.
Are you a diver?
I became a diver in order to explore. Both my wife Santa, who takes the photographs, and I, at the end of 1996, we happened to be at a conference in the Los Angeles area, and we went out to Catalina Island in quite cold weather, and we took the first PADI certification, which allows you to dive anywhere. Of course, at that stage, you've only done four dives. You're not a very experienced diver, and certainly we weren't, and we really cut our teeth on diving in the most difficult and strenuous circumstances in Yonaguni, starting in March the following year, 1997. And since then, we've put in about 200 dives on the five major structures that lie offshore of Yonaguni.
So you're sure a diver now?
Yeah, we've become divers, and I feel good underwater. I never underestimate the sea. The sea is a god, and you don't mess with gods. But if you go with the flow and listen to its anger when it's angry and relax with it when it wants to take you in a certain direction, it's a good place to be. And I've learned a lot about diving. I've learned a lot about breath control, because that's a very important thing underwater. New divers tend to overbreathe and limit their time very much underwater. So what you learn after a while is a certain calmness and a certain relaxation, and this helps a great deal. In fact, it's a great therapy for everyday life in every way.
Exactly. What did you find?
Well, what I've finally come to realize is that although everybody focuses on the one terraced structure, which the Japanese call Iseki Point, literally Monument Point, which lies at depths of between 60 and about 100 feet underwater off the south coast of Yonaguni, that it is not alone. In fact, it's one of a string of structures that run all the way along the south coast of Yonaguni, with a total covering a total distance of about 7 miles. And there are five distinct structures laid out along the coast. Four of them are cut out of solid rock, and this is why we keep having the argument about is it man-made or not.
Yes, yes. Well, how sure are you?
I'm absolutely 100% certain, and so are many scientists, that this is a man-made structure. It's a megalith, a series of structures. These are megalithic structures. They're very typical megalithic architecture, and they're also rock-hewn structures. We find rock-hewn ancient structures all around the world. For example, on the island of Malta, there's a place called the Hypogeum, which is cut out of solid rock and goes down 30 feet below the ground. So cutting structures out of rock is a well-known method of ancient construction, and that's what we're looking at off the south coast of Yonaguni. And, you know, if there was only one thing there, and it was just one weird thing, I think it would be irresponsible to insist that it's man-made. But when you see that it's a complex of five different structures, all quite different in character, not the same as one another, but different in character, but all megalithic or monolithic. And when you look in close detail at the way that they're worked and that what has been done to make them look the way they look, you cannot reasonably come to any other conclusion that these are man-made. And what I've tried to do also in the book is to show that there was an ancient culture in Japan which is known to archaeologists, which goes back 16,000 years, a culture called the Jomon. And what I've tried to show is these were the people who were responsible for this fantastic work of architecture off the coast, not just of Yonaguni, but also of a whole series of islands.
Who were the Jomon?
Well, the Jomon, they're recognized by archaeologists as mysterious in one respect. They're thought to have been rather simple hunter-gatherers. But 16,000 years ago, they were the first people in the world to invent pottery. And that has always been an oddity. Why would hunter-gatherers, at a very supposedly a very simple level of development, have come up with this invention, the very useful invention to mankind, at least 5,000 years before anybody else known to history did so?
Well, because after you've hunted and gathered, you've got to put it in something?
But you've got to figure out how to do it. And the fact is, nobody else figured it out, at least according to the historians, until many, many years later. So there was always that mystery about the Jomon. As I began to investigate them more and more, I found Japanese archaeologists were stumbling across all sorts of stuff that didn't make sense, including evidence that the Jomon were growing rice 12,000 years ago. Now, that is 8 or 9,000 years before anybody else in the world was growing rice. And finally, when we take into account what is lying around the shores of Japan, now underwater, but above water 12,000 and more years ago, we're beginning to look, I think, at a forgotten episode in the history of a known culture, which at a very early stage in its development was capable of massive works of architecture.
Okay, well, with regard to these structures, is there any way to guess at function?
I think that the function in all cases is fairly clear. These are monumental works. They strike the eye very forcefully. They have their own aura and atmosphere. And the creation of monumental structures connected to religious activity is a very old custom already in Japan. Indeed, the creation of those structures out of rock. There's an ancient tradition in Japan, nobody knows where it comes from, of venerating mysterious-looking rocks and then actually working those rocks, maneuvering them, re-manipulating them, positioning them in different places so that they create the right harmony and the right atmosphere. And in Japanese tradition, there are two ancient texts, the Nihongi and the Kojiki, which were first written down about 1400 or 1500 years ago, but which were based on much older oral traditions that were gathered together by the early emperors at that time. And what these books speak of is a time that they call the Age of the Gods, which is specified to have been more than 10,000 years before these texts were written down. And in this miraculous and marvelous age of the gods, this cult of worshipping and creating monumental rock structures is said to have begun. And I think, again, that we're looking at a myth that is true and that's pointing us in the true direction, and that if we open our eyes, instead of seeing a culture of simple hunter-gatherers who mysteriously invented pottery, who mysteriously grew rice 12,000 years ago, who mysteriously, despite being hunter-gatherers, had permanent large-scale town-like settlements 10 or 11,000 years ago, what we see when we look underwater is a culture that was also building monumental structures in stone, shifting and manipulating blocks weighing up to 100 tons each, and that must force us to reconsider entirely our concept of these people.
Sure, and sounds like the Egyptians.
Yeah, it sounds like the Egyptians. What's marvelous about the Jomon is that they existed as a culture, and as I say, archaeologists know this, from 16,000 years ago down to 2,000 years ago. They remained intact as a recognizable, definable culture through all that period. They never fought wars. There's no evidence of any conflict amongst the Jomon. They always seem to have been prosperous. They seem to have found, I don't know, the secret of living in the world. And I think that taking the inquiry underwater is the next step to understanding the mystery of these people who were there, who witnessed the end of the Ice Age, and whose great structures, I believe, were destroyed by it.
You said they discovered the secret of living in the world.
Yeah. They managed to, imagine that, a culture that stayed intact for 14,000 years. I mean, the Egyptians were amazing. They stayed intact for 3,000 years. Long enough. We don't know of any culture that existed and kept its identity through longer than that, except the Jomon. They stayed intact for 14,000 years. And that is an extraordinary achievement. We often think that a culture which keeps its identity and stays intact for so long is somehow stuck in the mud. I think not. I think it's a culture that has found how to live in the world and not to eat itself up and consume itself as so many later cultures did.
Okay, well, your critics and the critics of those stone structures off the coast of Japan, they say, well, you know, it's nothing.
It's natural.
It's natural. It's like the face on Mars. It's
that's
a
right.
trick of shadows, and it's it's just rock,
that's,
for God's
right.
sake. So how do you prove that they're wrong?
Well, they have a right to that point of view. But this is, again, one of the reasons why I've written Underworld, and I've tried to take very much account of the critical point of view. I took a German geologist, Wolf Wichmann, who works with Der Spiegel magazine, very down-to-earth guy and absolutely does not believe in lost civilizations. I took him to Japan with me because he has always been against the idea of the structures at Yonaguni being man-made. But I also took him to another site off the island of Okinawa, off a group of islands called the Keramas. And I took him underwater to a depth of 110 feet where a gigantic stone circle stands on the seabed. Gigantic. The stones are the uprights are 12 feet high. The thing has a vast scale. It's one of the most striking things that ever can hit the eye.
12?
And after a series of dives on the stone circles at Kerama,
yes.
Wolf Wichmann had to admit, there's no way that nature could have made this.
Yes, did you say 1,200 feet high?
No, 12. 12 feet
12
high.
Feet
the uprights
high.
Are 12 feet high. They're massive stone uprights arranged in a beautiful circle on the seabed with a clear path running between the stones around a central upright. And they are cut out of very, very hard rock because we took samples. And the work of cutting them in itself would have required an advanced culture.
And so you believe religious significance of some sort?
Yes, I do. Stone circles continued in Japan. Stone circles continued to be made, but on a much smaller scale in later periods of time. This is something that's not well known. Japan.
Many modern religions, construct stone circles.
Indeed, yeah. There's something about the circle. There's something about building and creating a monumental circle in stone, which touches something in us.
Maybe that's because life is a circle. Graham Hancock, stand by. We're at the top of the hour. Under our oceans, all around us, evidence of those who came before. I wonder if we'll leave evidence like that. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Mississippi,
Short Bell in the Kingdom of Nye. From west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
A new religion that'll bring you to your knees. I wonder if that's what they're afraid of. Good morning, everybody. My name is Art Bell. I've got Graham Hancock here, who's authored many, many, many books about what once was. His latest is Underworld. Check it out on my website. In the meantime, we'll be talking about it. Well, all right. Once again, here is Graham Hancock, A New Religion That'll Bring You to Your Knees. We've already got enough religions, and I think one of the things they might be worried about, Graham, is that we would get exactly that. In other words, if we knew the whole truth, there'd be something new to in essence, worship. And, boy, that cuts across lots of laps out there. I mean,
yeah, it does. Although I remain convinced that the inquiry into the mystery of what we are and why we're here is first of all essentially a spiritual inquiry, and secondly it's something that the ancients or certain ancient cultures knew better than we do, and that's why I feel that we can only benefit from a revelation of what is hidden from us in our own past. It's just like a person with amnesia cannot experience the world properly. If we can recover what we've lost from the past, then I think we will understand ourselves better and why we're here better. And I can only believe that will lead to a better and not a worse life. The problem with religion, with the idea of religion, that it's so often converted into this notion of mindless worship just blind faith, but when I look at the ancient cultures, that's actually not what I see. I see a religion that stimulates and encourages personal inquiry, and that says you have a brain for a reason, use it, don't waste your life.
How do you come up with that from what you've studied?
Well, it's very clear in the ancient Egyptian religion and how this evolved into another religion around about the time of Christ that was generally known by the term Gnosticism. And Gnosticism means knowledge. It's not a religion of faith. It's a religion of knowledge, of finding the key to life and of finding it by personal experience and personal inquiry. Again and again, if you study the ancient Egyptian religious texts, you see that there is this emphasis on knowledge, of on understanding, and of living our life as though it were a work of art that we're given 70 or whatever years to however many we get to work on and to perfect. And this is so far removed from the notion of blind faith that we find in more recent religions. And it's always been interesting to me that Gnosticism and Hermeticism, which I do believe are the intellectual descendants of the ancient Egyptian faith, of the ancient Egyptian religion, how they were stamped out and punished by the Christian Church, unfortunately, in the early days. There were terrible burnings and persecutions.
Can you explain Gnosticism?
In a sense, it is seeking the knowledge of the mystery of life. Understanding, absolutely understanding why we're here, realizing there's much in common with Buddhism and Hinduism also, realizing that what we see as material life is not reality, or at any rate is not the only reality. It's a place into which we're plunged. It's a theater of experience. We're dealt the cards almost according to a lottery. Who knows what kind of life circumstances we're going to get, but only we are in control of the choices we make confronted by those circumstances and what we do with them. And the ancient Egyptian religion always dwelt on that, that our choices are our own, but we must live with the consequences of those choices.
Mm-hmm. But it didn't embrace the traditional creation model.
Oh, there is not the creation model as we see it through Christianity, but there indeed is a notion of creation, a very beautiful notion of material reality being sung into existence by the gods with the voice and the word of a god, specifically the god Thoth, the god of wisdom, brings the world into existence with a word, and that you are reminded there of the New Testament notion of the word as something above and beyond just the plain simple meaning of a word. So there is a notion of creation as though this level of reality is created and is created for creatures in material form to face challenges, to confront themselves, to learn why they're there. And when you learn, it seems that the first point of learning why we're here is to understand that it's an illusion, that it is not all there is, that it's only a tiny fragment of reality. And once you understand that, then you understand many other things as well.
Okay, well,
this, of course, is easier said than done.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't it? It's rather easy, then, is it not, to believe that civilizations, perhaps not just 16,000 or more years ago, but even in cycles prior to that, have come and gone and come and gone, and man has come and gone.
Yes.
Life as we know it has come, or maybe as we don't know it, has come and gone.
Yeah, I think that becomes a reasonable conclusion. And then when you bring our best modern tools of science to bear on this, you do find that the Earth has been through cataclysmic processes many times in the last millions of years. Many times the Earth has wiped itself clean. The one I know best about is the end of the Ice Age, and in many ways that was like a huge eraser being rubbed across the surface of the Earth and just rubbing out the previous world. I mean, just to give an example of that, the ice caps that sat on the northern hemisphere, and particularly over North America and over Chicago, where I'm sitting now, these ice caps were 2 miles thick, and they pressed down on the Earth, creating huge basins underneath them up to 2,000 feet deep because of the weight of the ice caps. And those ice caps were in motion. They were grinding across the ground like enormous glaciers. So anything that had been there before is thoroughly and completely rubbed away. It is just absolutely inaccessible. We will never know what was there before the ice caps were laid in place.
Can you imagine, Graham, a civilization of the magnitude that we now have in North America getting virtually erased?
Yes, I can. I can imagine that. So dramatically and comprehensively erased that almost nothing is left. Again, you know, you come back to the flood. It's not just an issue of rising sea levels. The ice that melted on those ice caps didn't just drip away into the sea. It accumulated in enormous lakes on the top of the ice caps. And remember, those lakes are 2 miles above the land surface. When the border of the lake broke, when the plug or the dam that held that water in place, and that might have accumulated 4,000 years of melting, when it broke, and mainstream science accepts this, we had the most awful and cataclysmic floods pouring down off the ice cap, waves that were running at 1,000 miles an hour, 600 feet high, roaring down the ice caps at fantastic speed, tearing across the lands, creating the Finger Lakes of northern New York State, the Scablands of New Jersey in the process, and bursting into the sea and then raising the sea levels. Anything that stood in the way of those catastrophic floods pouring off the land would just have been swept away forever.
Well, you know, here's something interesting to think about, Graham. Right now, we have signs that there are disturbing things beginning to occur with our climate.
Yes, very.
Even some of the best climatologists are now prepared to suggest that very rapid climate change is indeed possible. I mean, this is all pretty recent stuff.
And it is recent stuff.
And with what you're suggesting and what they're suggesting, one of the reasons people might not want to buy into any of this is because they're scared.
It is a very scary prospect.
If it happened before, and we've got these nervous little changes in climate going on right now, why? You never know. It just might happen again. And people don't want to think about that.
Not at all. They don't. It's a scary and a destabilizing thought. And what this new science is showing us is that the kind of period we live in now, which is technically an interglacial, a period between ice ages, has in the past, there have been a series of interglacials in the past, and these, the last one was called the Eemian, and these interglacials have been very turbulent times in terms of climate.
Uh-huh.
Very rapid climate flips, very strange weather conditions, wild and dangerous weather. And really the last 10,000 years we've had it good. We've had it much better than it's been in previous interglacials. And what seems to be happening now with the wildness in the weather, the unpredictability of the weather, indeed the flooding that's taking place all over the world, is a reversion to type, that we seem to be coming back into the rhythm of the Earth. And that rhythm, unfortunately, promises troubled times ahead.
Where else are you going to take your research? Off the coast of Japan, off the coast of Cuba?
Underworld is a worldwide investigation.
Exactly.
It focuses on a number of specific locations, which is the east coast of China, between Taiwan and China, around Japan, all around the islands of Japan, and the incredible mystery that I believe that Japan represents, which we've never understood in the West, and it's never really been written about in the West before. It focuses also on the Mediterranean, with particular reference to the island of Malta. A little-known place lies about 90 miles south of Sicily. Today, it's just a group of three tiny islands. But 12,000 years ago, those three tiny islands were joined together and connected by a land bridge 90 miles long to the southern tip of Sicily. And all of that was flooded with the rising seas at the end of the Ice Age. Now, Malta contains very mysterious structures on land, supposedly the oldest freestanding temples in the world, gigantic megalithic constructions again. No evidence of any background to the construction of these things. They just come out of the blue. I've investigated the possibility and dived to investigate that possibility that the answer to this mystery may be underwater, where the archaeologists haven't looked, where the evolution and the early stages of this of these bizarre and amazing temples are to be seen. And then off the Bahama banks, particularly Bimini, where I think everyone's heard of the Bimini Road, and most people believe that the Bimini Road was thoroughly debunked many years ago and written off as just a peculiar natural formation. I've re-examined this mystery in Underworld, and I've tried to show that it may have been written off much too quickly. A very interesting eyewitness accounts that...
How long is the Bimini Road?
1,800 feet in length.
Pretty long.
It's very long, and it's a series of megalithic blocks placed side by side, and the orthodox view is that this is a thing called natural beach rock, which formed naturally in situ. And I can understand why that's the orthodox view. And I've talked to some of the scholars, such as John Gifford from the Miami Oceanographic Institute, who hold that view. But I think that the view may well be misplaced. And I've tried to present a solid body of evidence. That's really been my theme throughout this book, is to provide new material that's strong and solid and stands up on its own.
All right. How about this, Graham? I'm going to try and shoot a hole here and shoot back.
Mm-hmm.
After all, we can go back and we can find the bones of dinosaurs, what, 65 million years ago or whatever?
Indeed.
And it would seem that if there were some worldwide catastrophic event, that there would be land archaeological artifacts to support what you're finding under the oceans as well. I mean, if we can find the bones of dinosaurs, we ought to be able to find what's left of the civilizations we're talking about occasionally on land as well,
right? Good question and a good point. And I think there's two answers to that point, particularly with reference to the end of the Ice Age. One answer is where would, if hypothetically there were civilizations during the Ice Age, where would they have positioned themselves?
Mm-hmm.
They would not, in my view, they could not have positioned themselves on top of the ice caps.
No.
That would have been quite out of the question.
Good point.
Nor could they have positioned themselves on the land adjoining the ice caps, the interior of the continents. At least they could not have been prosperous there. because the climate was horrific. It was extremely cold. It was extremely dry. It was absolutely hostile to human life.
So they'd be in very southern latitudes.
So they would be in southern latitudes, and they would be close to the ocean. They would be close to the resources of the sea, where the sea provides a kind of microclimate of its own.
Makes sense, yes.
And also allows people to travel, because these ice caps are blocking the land masses to travel. The best way to travel is by sea. So the higher cultures, the more advanced cultures of that period would naturally have gravitated and held the coast as their own. And it's precisely those coastal areas that were swamped when the sea level rose. That disappeared from view at that time. And that's why I use the title Underworld, because I believe there is a whole underworld of unexplored territory where we just don't pay attention to it because it kind of doesn't strike us as important to do so. But when we think about it, when we put ourselves back at the end of the Ice Age in the world as it was then, it's precisely those areas now underwater that people would have chosen to live in.
So then even our buildings, our structures, our infrastructures all across North America, they don't mean much to an Ice Age.
No, they don't. They don't mean much to an Ice Age at all. Not at all. An Ice Age is way beyond all of that. But another point is, and this touches on some of my previous work, is that I do believe that there are quite a number of large-scale structures scattered around the world on land, such as the Great Sphinx, which have been misdated, which actually do belong to an earlier epoch, but which we have found ways to fit into the established picture of the past.
By the way, I haven't talked to you since the program. You recall the Fox program?
Indeed, I do.
And I wonder if you had any comments on all of that. I did, of course, interview Robert.
Yeah, I know. I thought it was really awful, the way that it was done. It was one of the most exploitative pieces of television that I've ever seen. And
yeah.
It's what we call a wind-up in England.
Yes.
Where they just keep winding you up and winding you up and winding you up. Until you come to the last minute, and they knew all along what they were going to show us, I believe.
And it really did seem that way.
It really did seem that way. I mean, I would have been more convinced if I'd seen them drill that hole, but the fact that it was pre-drilled, and I'm asked to believe that nobody looked through it beforehand, I don't think so. And if they'd looked through it, they would have seen what we saw when the camera did go through it, which is very interesting, a second door beyond it. Very interesting indeed, but doesn't justify, what was it, 2 hours of exploitative TV beforehand that we all sit and watch. If they told us the truth, none of us would have watched it. So a terrible wind-up, and unfortunately, a wind-up driven by an agenda, which is the agenda of Orthodox archaeology, because old Zahi there, our mutual friend, and he is a good guy. I like Zahi. I love him dearly. But he, you know, he was taking every opportunity to bash the lost civilization idea.
Oh, I know.
Even though it wasn't necessary, even though it wasn't called for.
Well, you know how Zahi is.
I know.
Yeah. All right, hold on. We're here at the bottom of the hour. That's just how Zahi is. Bash those who don't believe this, because it was our Egyptians who did it all. Any other ideas is heretical, right? We're going to break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back from the high desert. This, of course, is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born.
Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
Incidentally, those wishing to reach me may do so at the following email address. I'm Art Bell, that's A-R-T-B-E-L-L, at mindspring.com. That's Art Bell at mindspring.com. Graham Hancock is my guest. His new book, Underworld, is what we're discussing. Underworld. That would indicate under everything. That is what's left. Somehow, perhaps, the water kept all of this in slightly better shape. You know, whether it would be ancient civilizations, or perhaps the rocks that built the pyramid that we surely don't understand. In some ways, these people understood either how to make of rock or to move rock that we, in ways that we simply cannot fathom today. That is perhaps, except one minor or major modern example, and that would be the Coral Castle down in Florida. I wonder if you ever got around to looking into that at all, Graham?
No. Is the short answer. I've not been to the Coral Castle. Of course, I've read about it and know a bit about it. It seems to me a fascinating problem. And I completely agree with you. There was an ancient and it seems globally distributed technique for manipulating huge masses of stone.
Yes.
With relative ease.
Yes.
With relative ease. We can't do it. We cannot do it today. Of course, we can manipulate the masses of stone, but we require mechanical advantage. We require enormous things like cranes to move it around. And even cranes can't lift the weights that some of these stones are, like the stones used in the Vali Temple in front of the Sphinx, for example.
Well, exactly. So does that suggest to you that they understood or had a technology, or perhaps were able to spiritually even... Yes?
Yes. the word spiritually is right. I think that what seems to me, and I suspect many people share this view, is that we're only realizing a tiny fraction of our potential today. The human creature has much more potential within us than we are able to realize. And the social context in which we live can either act as an accelerator for our potential, as I think it often did in the past, or it can act to inhibit our potential. And unfortunately, that's what modern society is doing. It's telling us we don't have the potential ourselves within us. We must make machines in order to do those things that we dream of doing. Maybe there's a whole other way of manipulating and moving in the physical world, which we have simply not explored, because we've been taught to use the powers of our mind to create machines, not to act on the physical world directly. And I think there was an ancient science, if you like, which has come down to us as memories of magic, which worked with the physical world directly through the power of the mind. That may sound very far-fetched, and I freely admit that it's total speculation, although there is a basis for it in ancient traditions from all around the world. But when I look at some of these structures and the way they've been put together and the way these vast stones have been manipulated, it's the only reasonable conclusion I can come from, at least this, that they knew something we don't know, and it would be very interesting for us to know it.
I don't know that that makes them right and us wrong.
No, it doesn't. It's just different paths.
A very different paths.
Yeah.
And I wonder if any path that man takes prevents the cycles that you believe to be true. Pretty big question.
It's a very big question. And ultimately it brings us back to spiritual issues. Is there is there a purpose and a meaning to human life, to the life of each individual, or
yes.
what is it, 6 or 8 billion of us on this planet?
Yes.
Or is it simply an accident that evolved entirely by accident out of the chemical soup long, long ago? Well, what all the ancient texts say is there is a purpose, there is a meaning, and the choices and the direction that we humans take rebounds on the universe that surrounds us, that it extends far beyond ourselves. And I can't help feeling there's something to that. And that's why I keep coming back to this issue of personal choice and what we do with our lives. None of us can change the world, but all of us can change our immediate environment. We can change the world around us. We can behave in a different way to our own family. We can behave in a different way to our own friends and enemies. We can choose to do that if we want to. And if everybody were to make perhaps a more generous choice, a gentler choice, than we tend to make in this crazy world that we live in.
Do you think that these ancients believed that one could essentially sin and then be forgiven for it in the afterlife?
No. The ancient Egyptian texts are very clear on this matter. When you follow them through into the Hermetic texts, it's stated quite explicitly. In fact, the Hermetic texts from about 200 AD say it's better to pay the price in this life than the next, but you will pay the price. You will pay the price for what you do. There is no escape from that. It's part of the balance of the universe. We don't get away with anything. I'm convinced of that. People may lead an evil and malicious life and benefit from it for 70 years, but at the end, they will pay, and they'll pay a terrible price in terms of their immortal destiny.
Would you believe it to be true that not only is there an individual price to be paid, but there is a larger societal price to be paid, that when you reach a certain level of debauchery and corruption and essential uselessness, that things are wiped clean? Or is that simply a sort of religious-based myth?
No, I don't think it's a myth. In fact, some of the hard lessons of recent history show it to be so. The Buddhists would call it karma, that there is such a thing as a national karma, as a societal karma, and if a society goes down the road of destruction, of cruelty, of treating human beings as though they are consumable objects, of delighting in misery and pain, if a society goes down that road, sooner or later, it will be destroyed itself. It will either destroy itself or others will destroy it. It cannot stand.
Where virtually all traces, or most traces, are gone, then where is the learning? Where's the progression?
Very good question. Uh-huh. Very good question. I have to bring that down to the individual level, because that's the only level that any individual can really speak on.
Mm-hmm.
That the learning is in our own individual lives and in whatever life throws at us. A person may think that he's lucky to be born rich and prosperous. A person may feel that he's unlucky to be born poor and discriminated against. Yet it's possible that what we regard as a difficult life is the best preparation for what lies beyond, rather than an easy life. That's how it seems to me.
And yet, these people who had perhaps these abilities to move rock with thought or spiritual whatever.
Something went wrong.
They're gone.
Yeah.
They're gone.
Something went wrong. And again, if you study the myths, this is a universal theme, that the cataclysm comes not just because of blind natural forces, that the cataclysm is provoked by the actions of people. But somehow what we do redounds on the world and the universe around us and leads to a reaction from that world and that universe, and that we can go too far down a certain road and we will be stopped. In effect, we will have stopped ourselves by the choices we made. And we will get a chance to do it again, to go through it again, Somehow, perhaps the myths are a guide. Perhaps ancient songs and traditions that have come down to us from the past are a guide. Perhaps our own intuition is a guide. Everybody inside them, I believe, does know the difference between right and wrong.
But a lot of people, for example, listen to Hopi prophecy.
Yeah.
And the result is sort of a nervous chuckle, and
yeah,
then back onto the internet.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I had a very moving experience in the Hopi Nation back in 1994, where I met with and talked at length with a Hopi elder.
Uh-huh.
He changed my perspective on the world forever. There was such, Paul Sifki he was called, there was such gravity about him and such depth and such wisdom. Very, very extraordinary man. Speaking from his heart about the memories of his people and what these memories tell us for the future, which is that a terrible destruction is coming and it's in our hands.
Yes, that's exactly what they say. I actually did a program in which I interviewed a number of Hopi elders,
mm-hmm,
through an interpreter,
right,
and while it was arduous to listen to through an interpreter, mm-hmm, the message was very dire. Indeed,
yes.
And
very, very dire.
So you sort of listen to that, like you do many myths, and you nervously chuckle and you dismiss it,
and you move on. And so
where, I say again, where is the learning? Well, maybe individual, but not enough.
No, there's this sense of powerlessness that we all have when confronted by the gross wrongs of the world that we live in. We feel somehow it's not my responsibility. It's somebody else's problem. And in truth, there's very little that any individual can do to change things on a national scale,
mm-hmm,
unless he happens to be in a position of enormous power. And even then,
it
would be very difficult to change the course of a nation.
Yeah, even then he's pushed, as is our president right now, in specific directions.
That's right. Huge forces are at work, which it's very hard for any individual to deal with. So what I come back to is, what is the sphere in which an individual can operate? And that's in the immediate sphere that surrounds us. And if we take the trouble to make that better, if everybody takes the trouble to make that better, and I know it sounds wishy-washy, but it's true. If everybody takes the trouble to make that better, then it is going to change the world. It is going to change the world. But if we give up and we don't hope and we don't believe that we can do something, if we just feel utterly powerless and don't bother, then, of course, the world will go along on its present direction.
And its present direction is very worrisome.
Very, very, very worrisome. Where the value of human life seems so low in the world today, or seems to be valued so low. I mean, I almost dread to talk about it.
Very much cheapened.
This horrific sniper story in Washington at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a person who lines up his gun on people he doesn't know and shoots them dead.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a person who is far, far divorced from reality and from the suffering and the agony that he is causing in the lives of all the people around those people who've been killed, and beyond them, in the lives of the nation as a whole and the world as a whole, that a human being can do this to a fellow human being.
And those who brought the buildings down in New York.
And those who brought the buildings down in New York.
And those who are cooking up the witch's brew of things that may be the only things left on Earth after the biologicals are done. I mean that could be our end. Nothing but some germs left floating about.
And all of it comes from a disregard for the sacred value of human life. I think if a person understood that life is sacred, above all, it is sacred. It's a precious gift. Each of us given those 70 or 80 years or 50 or 40, however many years we're given, to live our life and learn, to take that away from a fellow human being, to steal it from a fellow human being, to deny them that potential is an act of unutterable wickedness and evil. If only that could be realized, then these kind of things would not happen, could not happen. There is no good reason to steal the life of a fellow human being. And somehow we've become so distanced from each other that seeing a death in a movie on TV becomes no different from seeing a real death in real life.
Mm.
And it's this terrible distance that's grown between human beings, which is a cancer that's eating away at every one of us. And it was a poet, John Donne, many, many years ago, who said, "Each man's death diminishes me." We're none of us are islands. We're all connected to each other, and we're all part of the main. And an act of wickedness affects us all. How to change it? Begin with yourself. Begin with the individual choice. Begin with the people around us. Spread it out from there.
As you point out, though, easier said than done, and the world seems clearly to be going in a totally opposite direction.
Mentally. Incredibly unreasonable,
so,
irrational violence,
yes.
really tribal behavior, maximized onto a global scale, behavior that was perhaps appropriate in a totally different set of circumstances and different environment, but not in the world that we live in today. And somehow we haven't learnt to rein ourselves in and behave decently and reasonably towards one another. That's all that's needed, really, is just to put yourself in the other fellow's shoes and think, what was it like for him? What is it like? What is it like to have a member of your family killed in cold blood by an unknown stranger just for the hell of it? What does it mean to that person's milieu, to his sister, to his mother, to his son? What does it mean? And think how awful it is and how terrible the agony is. Then nobody could do it. But somehow we don't think that. We don't think it enough.
No, and we live in a day and age when what you see on CNN and what you see on dramatic television isn't really different.
Not different at all.
One reflects the other.
Exactly. And that's why I think, I mean, I actually refuse to watch films that glory in horrific violence. If it's kind of cartoon violence, you know, where you know that it's just nonsense, but where they actually dwell on the violence and the pain, I will not watch it because I feel it makes me a smaller person. I feel I am actually diminished by watching such a thing, and I just won't. And I do think, there's been arguments for years about whether television and the media, the movies, have an effect or not. I think they do have an effect. I think they have a very insidious effect of distancing us from the reality of fellow human beings, of distancing us from their warmth and their lives and their network. Somehow we just see them as a character in a story. Who can be rubbed out or not, as the case may be, and I think that's the most insidious effect of some of the worst offerings of the film industry.
You have written so many books that have dealt with our past that you have been virtually for most of your adult life now dwelling on our past collectively, haven't you?
Yeah. 10 years, actually.
So what we're hearing now are conclusions.
A major focus for me. Sorry, Art, say again?
I say, so what we're hearing now are really sort of grand conclusions that you've come to.
Yeah, I am coming to conclusions. And in fact, I've also decided that Underworld is the last book that I will write on the theme of a lost civilization. I will continue to write books, but I feel that I've taken with Underworld the investigation into the lost civilization possibility and presented the evidence in the best form that I can and tried to really open the door into a common sense practical inquiry into this mystery. I feel that I don't want to take it further than that. I hope other people will take it further than that. I don't want to become repetitive. I don't want to go around in a circle saying the same things again and again. I want to move on and keep myself fresh and keep challenging myself. And so after Underworld, which I feel has put the seal on what has been 10 years, actually rather more, 12 or 14 years of focused work on the lost civilization mystery.
Yes.
I want to move on from there.
Yes, you've been at it rather as long as I've been at doing this kind of program. Graham, hold on. We're going to open the lines when we get into the next hour. And a lot of people have been following your career, and your conclusions are extremely interesting. For somebody who's been looking into the possibility that man's been here again and again and again, those conclusions are really interesting. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
with no peace of mind. And I'm ready for the times to get better.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
It is that. Good morning, everybody. I'm Art Bell, and I should tell you that I'm really having... It's like somebody's behind me right now with a knife, stabbing it into my lower back. And I'm not sure that I'm going to make it through this hour. We'll see how it goes. But that's kind of what's going on right now. Listen, I'm going to, I think I'm going to have to apologize to Graham. You're there, Graham. And,
hi, Art. I can hear the pain in your voice.
Oh, can you really?
Yeah.
And I'm really getting attacked right now, Graham. And so I'm going to bow out a little bit early. But, brother, I want to thank you for being on the program with me.
That's been my pleasure, Art.
And, your new book, I hope everybody will go out and get it. It's obviously your final work on this subject.
On the Lost Civilization subject.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so...
It's Underworld. It's called Underworld. And Art, again, can I mention to your audience, I am giving a series of talks with slides across America. And the details of those talks, which take place during the next 10 days, are all on my website, which is www.grahamhancock.com, on the Underworld page, at the top of the Underworld page. And I hope to see some of your great listeners at those talks.
Indeed, I'm sure you will. Graham, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Art. Get better. I don't know what's happened to you, but I hope you feel better soon.
Take care, Graham.
Talk to you soon.
All right, folks. I am going to bail out a little bit early and take you on a sort of a time trip into the fairly a distant past, I suppose, with a program that we did not too long ago. And so if you're ready at the network, would you please roll that? Thank you.